And he inclined unto me and heard my cry. He brought me up also out of an horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock, and established my goings. And he hath put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it, and fear, and shall trust in the Lord. May it be so with us throughout this new semester. For this opening convocation, the first chapel service of the new semester, I thank God, and I know that many of you do, and especially am I grateful that we meet here in this chapel at almost the very beginning. Classes began at 8, but this is our first convocation, our first coming together, and I think it is wonderfully proper that we may assemble and that we do assemble in this, our lovely chapel. I trust that it shall become more and more the center of our worship and a symbol of our consecration and our fellowship together. I would especially welcome those who are new students. We have, I suppose, 20 or 30 who are coming to Southeastern for the first time, beginning their work this second semester. I suppose there are 20 or 30 or more who are returning after having missed at least the past semester and perhaps several. You have found you're able to return and pursue your studies. We're grateful for your coming, not so much because you come to help us, but because together we can, we trust, constitute a greater ministry for the Word of God and truth in our generation. I would welcome also those who visit us. Here's Dr. Cullum, I'm happy to see with us again. May he be here many more times. I see Miss Taylor and others. Any of you who are from the community or from any of the surrounding communities or from anywhere, if you're visiting us today, we are happy that you can be with us, and we hope you'll feel at home on all parts of the campus. And now may we bow together in prayer. Almighty Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, we thank thee for thy manifestation of thyself in so many of the channels thou hast created, channels of grace from thine own great self and being to the hearts of individual men. We thank thee for that great channel, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. We thank thee that as man he came revealing thy wonderful grace, forgiveness, infinity. We bow now in worship. And we would lift our hearts as well as our voices when we sing in praise. In understanding praise, because we do realize that although thou art God and we are men, thou hast come down to us. Thy revelation of thyself is for us and for our lifting up. Thou didst become what we are in order that we might become what Jesus himself is and was. Grant to us such fullness of thy grace, hearts so receptive to thy messages, that we become the kind of men who live the gospel as well as preach it, who show here and there throughout all the places of our service the significance of being Christian. Wilt thou bless each one individually as he needs. Bless us all together in those wonderful ways that can utilize the strength of one after another to constitute a greater strength than any of us can realize. In ways we know not how to ask thy blessings, but in ways that thy knowledge and wisdom and grace can nevertheless bestow, wilt thou give us what we need and make us what we ought to be. In Jesus' name, amen. We have the privilege this morning, and I'm happy to see that those of you who know Southeastern have been here before realize the privilege by being present here. The privilege of hearing one of our own, but one of our own whom we have come to deeply respect and have always loved. Dr. Richard Knox Young is a member of this faculty. He is also a member of the faculty of the Bowman Gray School of Medicine in Winston-Salem. And he is director of pastoral care. I think I have the term right. At any rate, he is the director of preacher helpfulness and counseling in the hospital, also in Winston-Salem. From the beginning at Southeastern, he has been teaching this matter of pastoral counseling for us and has led in a great way. I'm sure you know that he has become nationally recognized. Reader's Digest recognized him, and now NBC has been on his trail. They are trying to get him to participate in and direct some news items that they will broadcast in the country and over the world. Most of all, though, I think of Dick as a country boy who came up from North Carolina to the seminary in Louisville when I was trying to teach a little there, and was of such character and determination that he made good in spite of being from the sticks of North Carolina. And he becomes, in my mind, a symbol of what any one of us can be by consecration and persistence. I'm really happy that this friend whom I have loved and bandied so often in the years past is going to speak for us, as far as I have heard him, for the first time in our chapel this morning. Dr. Richard K. Young.
Thank you, Dr. Daly, President, friends. Your committee here was certainly very kind indeed to ask me to accept this responsibility this morning. Some of you in the classroom have heard me speak about a piece of research that we started about 7 years ago up at Baptist Hospital. We've recently completed it, and for whatever it's worth, it has not been in print, and it's being presented for the first time here today. It's on the minister's health. In 1961, one person in every eight in our society will spend some time in a general hospital. The lowest estimate available is that one-third of these people will have no identifiable organic problem to account for their symptoms. Much has been said of the changing conditions in our culture, which are constantly requiring the individual to make new adjustments. One of these individuals is the Christian minister, who is subject to the same pressures of change as any other member of our society. If the minister is to mediate health and wholeness of life to others, he must have a modicum of the same himself. Jesus recognized one's inability to minister to illness out of illness. He put it unforgettably when he asked, "Can the blind lead the blind? Shall they not both fall into the ditch?" According to Richard Niebuhr, there are three critical issues in the teaching of pastoral theology today. The first is the interpretation of the pastoral office in the care of souls within the church. The second is the collection of material on pastoral care and its interpretation for Christian faith and theology. The third is the growth of the pastor in self-knowledge, both as a person and as one who is to be a channel for the healing promised in the gospel. To set this subject in its proper perspective, it is important to acknowledge that there is a considerable amount of research being done today on the personal problems of the minister. Some have reacted to the current trend toward surveys with facetiousness, saying that the major problem of today's minister is that the time he should be using to get the job done, He spends navel gazing. Harry Golden has likewise commented whimsically on our predilection for polls. Quote, suppose there had been a poll by sampling in Rome in the year 60 A.D. The results would have been as follows. For Jupiter, 63% of them. For Mithra, 21% of them. For Jesus, 2% of them. Undecided, 14% of them. Continuing the quote, now if St. Paul had been a sampling man instead of a leader, he would have packed up and gone on back to Palestine. Especially after hearing what every taxi driver was saying, well, let's hang that little bald-headed Jew. But luckily for the Christian, Paul did not subscribe to any sampling polls, and so he just went ahead with his program and conquered the whole works. The Roman Empire, Jupiter, Mithra, including even the great goddess of Vestal Virgins. Unquote. What if the fact were established that the ministry was becoming the most introspective of the professions? Is this necessarily bad? If the minister is not to be introspective, who is? And if the minister fails to understand his own needs, his own feelings, how can he understand the needs and feelings of others? And how can he intelligently relate the gospel to the experience of his people? Research which bears on the situation of the minister today is being carried on in a broad spectrum of related fields. In the first place, we are keenly aware of the reexamination of the church and its ministry from the point of view of theology. Our own denomination has made some efforts in this direction. Perhaps the chief example of theological research on the ministry are the volumes of H. Richard Niebuhr and Associates, which are based upon an extensive survey of theological education in the United States and Canada. In the first of these volumes, Dr. Niebuhr points out that there are times in history when a clear-cut definition of the office of the minister gave security to those who filled it and those who prepared them for it. In the 20th century, however, there arose a considerable cloud of uncertainty as to the nature of the minister's role. Certain reasons are suggested to account for this uncertainty. One, a weakened sense of call or a loss of Christian conviction. Two, yielding to the demands of the public in order to attract people. Three, the loss of former functions to new agencies. Four, the result of intimate interaction between denominations. And five, the failure of traditional ministerial functions to keep up with the needs of the modern world. The problem of the minister, according to the Niebuhr report, is always, quote, how to remain faithful ministers of the church in the midst of cultural change and yet to change culturally so as to be true to the church's purpose in new situations. The role confusion of which Dr. Niebuhr speaks is also being examined sociologically. Dr. Samuel Blizzard, professor of Christianity and Society at Princeton Seminary, is perhaps the best known researcher in this area. He has studied both the ideological and the practitioner roles of a large number of ministers. In summarizing the dilemma which many modern ministers faces, he declares, quote, the theology they hold and the seminary instruction they received place the roles they perform in one priority order, but they actually spend their time doing those things they feel are least important. Denominational goals and programs and local parish needs determine the use of their time, but these activities bring the least sense of satisfaction, unquote. A third approach to the minister's adjustment is through the resources of psychological testing. Within the past decade, many theological seminaries and mission boards have moved toward the adoption of testing procedures and guidance and counseling services. This practice has posed no small problem for psychologists and psychiatrists, who are much more accustomed to the evaluation of individuals with some manifest difficulty. One practitioner who confronted this problem was Dr. Garthard Booth, who in the past 9 years examined over 350 candidates for the General Theological Seminary in New York and for the Episcopal Diocese of Newark. According to Dr. Booth, Only rarely are candidates for the ministry definitely sick. The majority come from the segment of the population which is considered normal from a statistical point of view. Whether a given individual is going to become sick depends on the particular correlation between his personality and the specific demands he has to meet. The ministry not only makes demands, but also meets some of the basic emotional needs in one's personality. A fourth area of research is the incidence of illnesses among ministers as compared with the general population. It is in this area that this paper seeks to make some little contribution. Several years ago, Chaplain Leonard Morgan made a survey of the hospitalization of ministers in state mental hospitals. He found that ministers were hospitalized in the same proportion as the general population, and that the denominational distribution of minister patients corresponded to the proportion of the population identified with our faith groups. Situated within a medical center and general hospital, the Department of Pastoral Care of the North Carolina Baptist Hospital has had opportunity to carry out research into the hospitalization of the ministers in a general hospital. The purpose of this research was to determine whether or not medical records would bear out the popular opinion that illness rates of ministers are excessively high today. An incidental motive for this study was to discover any evidence of a relationship between the minister's health and the demands of his vocation. The plan of the study consisted of locating and reading the medical records of 1,000 ministers treated in our hospital. Certain medical and personal data were transcribed from the medical chart onto a prepared form for tabulation. The same procedure was followed with a control group of 1,000 male patients, non-ministers, selected at random from the medical records library. When this was completed, the data on ministers could then be compared statistically with the data on non-ministers. Obviously, this was a tedious and time-consuming task, calling for the combined efforts of many interested people. The project has been under the immediate supervision of Dr. Albert Meyerberg, who has charge of research in the department. In addition to clerical assistance from the department secretaries, two chaplain interns, John Galloway and Dwight Cumby, were mainly responsible for part of the collection of the data and the tabulation of the statistical material. Mr. Cumby's THM thesis, based upon this research, has just been completed and will soon be available in our seminary library. A summary of the personal and social data of the subjects shows that the ministerial group and the lay group were matched in some ways, but not matched in others. The groups were comparable in that they came from the same region, were of the same age range, and were all seen in the hospital during the years 1944 through 1957. They were not comparable in that twice as many laymen lived in urban areas as did ministers, and 93 laymen were single as compared to 34 ministers. The control group of laymen was broad in its occupational scope, including job categories all the way from unskilled labor to the professional and managerial occupations. Likewise, in educational background, the ministerial group varied from grammar school to graduate degrees. The heart of the study lay in a comparison of the incidence of various illnesses among the two groups, ministers and laymen. For ease in tabulating and reporting, the public health code was used to classify diseases into 18 major categories, beginning with infectious and parasitic diseases, neoplasms, and continuing through such headings as diseases of the circulatory system, diseases of the respiratory system, and so on. An interesting pattern emerged from this scheme of classification. In some of the disease categories, the illness rates of ministers closely corresponded to those of laymen. For example, in infectious and parasitic diseases, there were 30 diagnoses among ministers as compared to 35 among laymen. Under neoplasms, which includes cancer, there were 71 ministers and 90 laymen. Diseases of the circulatory system numbered 273 ministers, 250 laymen. Disorders of the genitourinary system, which includes prostatitis, a common difficulty among older men, contained 166 diagnoses of ministers and 181 laymen. However, in other categories of illness, there was a marked difference in the illness rate of the two groups. For example, in diseases of the respiratory system, there were 112 diagnoses among ministers as compared to 74 among laymen. Under diseases of the digestive system, there were 233 ministers and 192 laymen. Allergic, endocrine, and metabolic diseases showed up among ministers 166 times, but only 100 times among laymen. Mental, psychoneurotic, and personality disorders accounted for 211 ministers as against 125 laymen. To digress for a moment, it sheds light on the above comparison to realize that medical science increasingly is questioning the traditional dichotomy of purely organic or purely emotional illnesses. The trend is away from an either-or and toward a both-and concept in everything from a bad cold to a brain tumor. The problem of medical diagnoses is to determine which factor is primary, the emotional or the organic. In other words, did an emotional factor produce the organic disturbance, or did the organic factor produce an emotional disturbance? That's your problem in medical diagnosis. Now, to return to the original comparison of disease categories where the numbers of diagnoses between ministers and laymen closely corresponded, the illnesses were primarily organic in origin. For example, out of 2,000 patients compared, there was a difference of only 23 between ministers and laymen with diseases of the circulatory system. On the other hand, in diseases of the respiratory system, the digestive tract, and allergic disorders, in which the importance of the emotional factor is well established in medical science, there was a marked rise in illness rates of ministers as compared with laymen. For instance, peptic ulcer, which is known as the doctor's minister's disease, it was 60% more frequent among ministers than among laymen. If this differential was found in only one category, its validity might be open to question. But in psychoneurotic and personality disorders, again, there was a 60% greater incidence of disease among ministers than among laymen. Furthermore, there were 2.5 times more ministers than laymen examined who revealed no identifiable organic problem to account for their symptoms. 2.5 times more out of 1,000 compared with 1,000 laymen. A second interesting finding in the study had to do with the patient's age at the time of hospitalization. Laymen are admitted to the hospital at a fairly uniform rate by decades, averaging 22% in decades 20 to 29, 30 to 39, 40 to 49. Not so with ministers. Only 9% of the ministers, compared to 20% of the laymen, were admitted to the hospital during the age span from 20 to 29 years. This increased dramatically in the next decade, ages 30 to 39, among ministers. Within this age bracket were found 34% of the 1,000 ministers as compared with 23% of the laymen in 30 to 39. In other words, admission to the hospital among laymen was fairly constant in each decade, whereas the number of admissions arose sharply among ministers 30, 39 years of age. How does one account for the fact that more ministers are hospitalized during the years 30, 39 than during any other decade in their lives? The interpretation of this fact leads to speculation, and yours is as good as mine. Obviously, the minister's vocational preparation consumes some of the years between 20 and 30. Another explanation might be, and I think this was the key myself, another explanation might be that these are the years in which the minister is most severely tested in his vocational adjustment. You either succeed or fail, one or the other, in that first and second passage. The two major conclusions of this of the study are: one, ministers are more subject to illnesses with emotional involvement than the laymen in this study, and two, ministers are more prone to hospitalization during the decade 30, 39 years of age. It is in order here to recognize some of the limitations of this research. First of all, this study involves only one region of the country. It is conceivable that parallel studies in other regions might produce different results. Second, the social and personal data from the medical records were not derived by the doctor, you see, primarily for this study, and were not as complete in some instances as were desired. We had the diagnosis, don't get me wrong on that, but we would like to have had more of the personal and social data to relate it to his vocation, another adjustment. Medical records contain much more personal and social data than they did even 10 years ago. Third, the ministers in this study were compared to the general population, whereas a truer comparison might have been attained from a study in relation to another professional group in order to minimize social and educational differences. A fourth limit of the research is that the ministerial group was predominantly of one denomination. A study of ministers of other communions might possibly come to other conclusions. Hence, criticism of this study would be acceptable from other denominations, but not from Southern Baptists. Because 738 of the 1,000 ministers were Baptists. So I'll take criticism from somebody else, but not from Baptists. In the face of the findings of this study, one is almost compelled to attempt some exhortation. I have had the privilege, and I say this humbly because I know how to say it, more grateful for it than anything else that's ever entered my life. I have had the privilege of counseling with a large number of ministers over the past 15 years on an intensive basis. I have noticed repeatedly that there are certain frustrating factors that arise in a minister's experience with which he must come to grips and make some type of adjustment. The first that comes to my mind is the impossibility of the task. Most people who work in the field of religion today have more than they can do, and they continually have to decide in just what areas they will invest that time. Because of these factors, a continual redefinition of the job becomes necessary. The longer you stay in one job, the more people you get to know, the more entanglements you pick up. Many times when I first came to the hospital, the first couple of years around there, I'd come off the floor about 11:45 and go to my office, go to the cafeteria and eat, come back to my office, prop my feet up, and take a nap for 45 minutes. I didn't have any correspondence to answer. I didn't have anybody calling me. I didn't know many people. I don't remember the last time I propped up my feet and took a nap in the daytime. Unless we structure our job in some way, in the midst of these demands, you could spend your full time in the preaching ministry, maybe the crisis ministry, the educational ministry, and on the administrative side of the church. Unless we structure our jobs in some way, we are going to be like the individual down in front of a dam. A leak springs in one place, and by the time he gets to stop, another one is gushing. In other words, we'll be operating on the basis of pressure. And any time you are operating on the basis of doing just what is pressuring you the most, it will not be long before you'll be skating on thin ice, emotionally. To avoid this, we should continually ask ourselves, in what area am I going to invest my time, and is this area in line with the real purpose of why I'm here, or the real purpose of my job? A second frustrating factor that the minister has to learn how to cope with, in my opinion, has to do with the emotional drain that takes place in constantly giving out. We are supposed to be continually giving out ideas, for example, searching for something to preach on Sunday morning. We continually lend out our emotions as we relate intensively with people. And so learning how to maintain a balance between objectivity and subjectivity becomes one of the problems in working with people. One day, not long after I came to this medical center, I was sitting in the cafeteria eating with a doctor. I said to him, because I was having a problem, I said to him, how do you keep from over-identifying or maybe under-identifying with these people? His answer was, I just don't think about it. That reply told me exactly what he was doing. He was looking at the bandage he was putting on and taking off, but wasn't seeing the person who was hurt. If we do not empathize and sympathize some of these people with whom we are working, we are not going to be worth a dime to them. But at the same time, if we over-identify, we just as well get in the bed with a patient. Or it's like the blind leading the blind. We each must learn for ourselves how to find and maintain the proper balance between objectivity and subjectivity. I said, find it for yourself. I cannot tell you how to save my life. You've got to find it in the middle of your own personality structure. I never will forget, as long as I live, walking out of that medical center out down the sidewalk one day after I'd been there 8 or 9 months, moving up and down the hall, spending an hour with a 32-year-old man that just lost his wife and had 3 preschool children. Well, I was married and had preschool school children at home. I couldn't help from identifying with that man. Moving on down the hall further, and here's a young man that's having to have a leg amputated. And then having the doctor call me a few minutes later and said, a man came in for a routine checkup, but we've discovered that he has a malignant growth. We're going in and tell him about it. Will you come along and follow us? I had been carrying that stuff home with me. I had not learned how to untangle myself from it. About 8 or 9 months, I walked out and started down the sidewalk. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I looked back up at that medical center, and this is exactly what I said, like it or not like it. I said, every dadgum one of them, you can die as far as I'm concerned. I'm going home. What was I really saying? I was really saying, I am not God. I realize that rather than letting God use me as an instrument and letting him flow through me to these people, I was assuming too much responsibility for their health and welfare. And I think I grew at that point. I'll never forget it as long as I live. A close minister friend of mine who's been preaching close to 30 years, and you'd know him if I'd call his name, and I don't think he'd mind me saying this. He said to me 3 or 4 years ago, he said, Dick, I prayed the shortest, most meaningful prayer in my life last week. I went into my study, got down on my knees, and said, Lord, from now on out, the rest of my ministry, I want you to be God. If we find the balance between objectivity and subjectivity, I believe this is the way we'll do it. A third frustrating factor that the minister has to cope with has to do with the limitations of his co-workers. You see a job that needs to be done on the campus, in the church, community, or wherever. You come in maybe as an outsider, as a pastor. You may even see a running sore in that community. But these people have been there so long that they've become blinded to it, and it happened gradually. You'd like to dive in and clean up this thing. But you've got to stand by. You must learn to start with people where they are before proceeding. Now to stand by and wait until you can teach them and raise their level is frustrating to me. I'd like to get in there and let's get going and clean this thing up. But if you get too far ahead of them, your relationship will be lost. A fourth frustrating factor that the minister has to cope with are the murmurings of his own unconscious. The murmurings of his own unconscious. As we relate intensively with other people, we constantly have our own emotional background yanked up into our conscious mind. When ministering to someone in times of bereavement or illness, we tend to relive similar emotional experiences out of our past. A counselee pouring out his problems about his childhood background may remind us of some intense problem in our own childhood background that's still unresolved. Carrie Horn and I say that 5 years of intensive counseling is equal to a psychoanalysis. I don't doubt it myself. That's one of the reasons I believe that every minister, if it were possible, could find enough skilled people. I believe that every single man entering the ministry ought to have anywhere from 7 to 10 hours of personal counseling from a skilled person. And I am not trying to drum up any business. That's because we cannot keep our feelings out of this situation. Now, I'm not saying that we are not supposed to have our personality into this thing. You couldn't do otherwise. I'm talking about the unhealthy idea in which we overreact because of something in our own background. But you will continue to have things yanked up into your own mind. The person out here that's plowing a mule doesn't have to think about anything but how much money he's going to make off the crop unless the hailstorm happens to tear it all to pieces, and then he can ask, why did this happen to me? This will be pulled up into your mind, the murmurings of your own unconscious. I've gone home more than one night with a tick in the corner of my eye. After I'd sleep and rest through the night, it would be gone. Something had happened in an intense relationship in that institution that had touched me very deeply and touched emotions unresolved in my background and pulled them up, but not quite to the conscious level, just enough to get the emotions up. A fifth factor that we cope with and must make an adjustment to is the necessity of working out a philosophy of life, with emphasis on the word necessity. We have no choice as to whether we will have a philosophy of life or not. We must have one of some kind if we're going to work with people. We are dealing with ultimates. We are constantly having people ask us questions. They're asking us many times why. And if we continue to work with these people, we must have some type of philosophy of our own. And it's painful to grow, you see. That's why this is frustrating. Anytime you have a new idea dropped into your mind, and it shakes up your philosophy that you already have, it becomes painful. You either reject the idea or you attempt to try to deal with it and grow. And it's frustrating. You don't ever grow 1 inch on any score without it being painful. And that's why I'm saying it's frustrating, because of the necessity of having to do something about it. The doctor even could go on taking out the stitches and putting in the bandages and refuse to face up to this thing. But I'm saying the Christian minister cannot. He must come to something with regards to these elements. Then a sixth frustration that the minister must cope with and learn to deal with has to do with his interprofessional relationships. And you know the people we feel most competitive with? They are the people that are doing more nearly the same thing we are. Because as we try to develop and grow in this field, there may not be but one top spot. Nothing wrong with ambitions, as long as we don't walk on somebody to get where we're going. But I have known, and you have known, in fact, I've known here on this campus since I've been associated with this seminary in more than one instance. Not a whole lot, but more than one time. You know everybody, there's not enough student pastors to go around to everybody in the freshman year, especially. And I've known the competition to get to the place that got a little unethical once or twice since I've been down here. I don't care if the man down here on the corner sells 1 million gallons of SO gasoline this month. But if I was selling Shell gasoline on the other corner, I'd be in there trying to get some business. So don't say that you don't have ambition. I know you have. And it's all right. It's healthy. Competition is healthy, so long as we don't walk on people to get where we're going. Another frustrating factor that the minister has to deal with has to do with success. I suspect that temptation is greater when we are achieving some measures of success than at any other time in our life. I know one thing. I know when I was rubbing my nose on a grindstone for 4 or 5 years trying to gain a relationship with the medical profession, you try that. That's the hardest group to get in with in our society, whether you know it or not. I didn't have any trouble praying. I could pray anytime. In my office, in my home at night, I was crying out and praying. I felt like I had hold of a truth, but I had to have relationships to operate. I didn't have any trouble praying. Well, you get to succeeding and see about the temptation. And remember this, God cannot succeed unless you succeed. In other words, if you break all relationships out here with those people, you cannot be used by him to get at those people. He may get at them through somebody else's life, yes. Certainly his kingdom is going on regardless of any of us. But as to what he wants to do with you and your talents, he can't succeed in this aspect unless you succeed. So there are frustrations connected with our concern to succeed. An eighth and last frustration that I'm going to mention has to do with your home life. Catholics saw this problem by demanding celibacy out of the priest, but I don't like that solution myself. Being called out at late at night can be a source of tension for you as a full-time religious worker. Up to a point, you are owned by your church community, up to a point. In other words, there are times when if you don't go, there's no need to ever go. If a carload of teenagers are picked up off the highway out here and brought to a hospital emergency room, and they get in touch with the pastor of that family, if he doesn't get up and head toward that emergency room, then there's no point in trying to minister to those people 3 days later. I'm saying that can be frustrating because you can have already promised your family that you're going on an outing with them, or you may be in the middle of a dinner entertaining friends. I'm saying that's frustrating in our home life, to be owned up to a point by others. And I'll go one step further and say, and I'm personally somewhat repulsive. Being too dogmatic is repulsive to me, personally. But I'm going to be dogmatic about this one here. Unless you make some plan of defense upon these impinging forces and demands that are coming in on the outside upon your family, unless you make some defense against it, your home is not going to contain the type of family it should. Now, in closing, let me mention some areas or speak back to this briefly. What can we do about these frustrating factors? What can we do to stay emotionally healthy, spiritually and emotionally? Just briefly. First and most important one of all, in my opinion, is your own private, personal, devotional life. You know, when I first came out of the seminary, going out here speaking to a minister's conference, or if I had been asked to be a speaker in this chapel here at a seminary, man, I'd have been any more mentioned something about your spiritual devotional life than anything in the world. But after counseling with several thousand ministers, I do not hesitate now to say something about your own private, personal, spiritual devotional life. And when I first began work at the hospital, the first 7 or 8 or 10 months, I'm just sharing this with you now. I learned this thing the hard way. That's why I hope no one will think this morning that I'm talking down in any way in the world to you. I'll get down here on the floor if you want me to. I'm simply sharing and trying to be honest, and if it's worth anything, all right. I learned this thing the hard way. Working intensively every day on a hospital floor when I was there by myself, averaging 6 or 7 hours on that floor out of the 8, I was praying sometimes 40 times a day. I was praying so much all day long in the hospital, I thought it was enough praying for anybody. But did you know in the midst of that experience that I waked up one day to find out that I had dried up spiritually just as dry as a bone? Your Sunday morning prayer is not going to do much to edify your own private spiritual life. I will go so far as to say that you'd better do something more than your family altar, and I'm for the family altar. I'm talking about the type of praying that you do riding down the road in an automobile by yourself. You don't take off the shell of your personality wholly and completely, even in your family circle. And I'm saying, you better not neglect that private devotional life. To be able to pray, we're going to have to pray some when we're alone. The sense of mission that we gain through private prayer is, in my opinion, the greatest factor in maintaining equilibrium in a personality. The sense of mission. Millions of people today in the world do not know where they came from, and they do not know where they're going. They don't know that they were made in the divine image of God. And they never can reach the maximum of their personality until they identify with Him. They are going around in a vicious cycle. Consequently, they get sick. Second, recreation. Now, I know once in a while you run into one of those happy Joes that recreates too much. Talking to one yesterday. But in my experience, they are few and far between, in my experience. I'll take up for the ministry as a whole here. In my experience, they are few and far between. Most religious workers do not take the time for recreation. Many ministers and religious workers can't play very well because they feel a twinge of guilt when they're not working. While on the golf course, they're thinking about somebody that should have visited. A well-planned schedule should allow time for both work and recreation, and if it's well-planned, then you won't feel guilty when you're playing. In other words, you don't do a good job of either when you feel about half guilty when you're playing. The religious worker needs to realize that the proper diet of relaxation and recreation can better prepare him physically and emotionally to meet the challenge of his work. Third, a sense of community. You need somebody on your own professional level with whom you can talk. And somebody who will love you in spite of you. Somebody who, when you're steamed up, will know that you're exaggerating and just blowing your top. Now, I'm not talking here about formal office counseling at all. I'm just simply saying that every person needs a close friend that they can exaggerate with, blow their top, and the other person understands and knows it don't mean half they're saying. We need that as a safety valve day by day. And I'm saying to the minister, I believe this man ought to be on your own professional level. I've known too many instances in which the minister tried to do this with a lay person and it backfired 2 or 3 years later. I'm seeing for counseling now, he's coming from another state, a Jewish rabbi. You might even go outside the denomination and find this man. We don't have to so much because we don't have bishops. You see the idea? A fourth suggestion is belief in your role and what you're doing. Belief in your role and what you're doing. I am alarmed at the number of people that I find about halfway in their role and halfway out of it. I'm alarmed about that. Personally, I was hesitant about going into the hospital chaplaincy. I felt God's leading, but I couldn't see where I was going. And my own pastor in my home church said it sure was bad that I was going out of the ministry. And when I got in the hospital, everywhere I turned, somebody had a stethoscope around the neck, or they had a tray with a procedure layout on it, and I had my testament in my pocket. I hadn't had anything in my hands and didn't know where to put them half the time. And you've never seen a more inadequate person. But little by little, I realized that I had hold of the most powerful medicine in this universe, the power of Christian love to heal. It will melt chips off shoulders. It will change human personality. If you can have the faith in the potentiality of the person and the patience to love him long enough, you can change human personality. It is the most powerful thing in this universe. Many times when I stop in a room, introduce myself and say, my name's Dick Young, I'm a minister working here full time. The next reply would come before they gave the name. Well, preacher, I'm glad you dropped by. I was just lying here thinking. I found out that the relationship between that patient and myself was already established on the basis of his past religious experience, his pastors, his church. I discovered that as hospital chaplain, I have a traditional role in my culture. And when I realized that, it made me proud of my role. I don't have any time in the wide living world for anybody that's about half in it and half out of it. And especially these jackleg psychiatrists and psychologists. These people that take it upon themselves to meddle around in somebody else's life and have not been willing to take a deep, long look at their own personality. And basically, they're scared to do it. And then try to counsel everybody around over the place. We don't let any man pass through our place for 1 year on an internship that refuses to sit in that other chair. If he does, he wouldn't stay with us 10 minutes. We have no right to meddle around in somebody else's life unless we're willing to take a good, long look at our own, in my opinion. I run into that quite frequently. A jackleg psychologist who was a minister that got to teaching psychology in college. He told a young girl, freshman girl, that she was a homosexual. She was no more homosexual than I was. That girl was taken out of college, put into another college. She ended up in our Carver Training School. 4 years in college, 3 years at Carver Training School, a two part in the seminary. About 7 years later, she went 7 years emotionally blocked up socially because she thought she was different and didn't date. I'm not betraying a confidence. She told me, as a religious person, because she went into the religious field, she got straight. Now, she told me, said, yell it from the housetops anywhere in the world if it'll help anybody. Today, that woman is married to a minister and has 3 children and is happy as she can be from a jackleg meddling around in somebody's life. I don't have any time in the world for it. Anything that you get out of psychiatry and psychologists, as far as I am concerned, is only a tool. And you don't anymore take it into the pulpit than you take your Hebrew book and your Greek book, your homiletics. You don't get up there and tell the congregation, I'm going to preach a topical sermon this morning. And I think that we are obligated, ethically obligated, to get information anywhere that can help us cut cleaner into the truth and help people. The last thing, I'll come back to the home again. The home as a place of refuge. The home as a place of refuge. Did you know that there are many, many homes in our society today that are not places of refuge? The home ought to be a place that you can come back to out of this big world out here and gain new strength to go back out into the big world. And how can a child who cries himself to sleep at night praying God to help dad and mother love each other and stop fussing, how can he go out there and adjust in the school? And remember, I said that your home will not be that way unless you make it. The other thing I'm alarmed about today is how many professional people, and I know doctors and ministers more than I do anybody else, how many of them are doing a sorry job with their home. They are too busy and neglect their children. If you don't have time to play piggyback with a two-year-old, don't come complaining to me if you've lost a relationship in adolescence. Because that's your door of communication is opened up when you're playing piggyback, and it'll carry on over to adolescence. Let me say this and close off. I learned, too, this one the hard way. If it's worth anything to you, I'll share it. After I'd been around the hospital 5 or 6 years, reached the place that was known some, I left out to go down to get in my car one evening, go speak to a PTA. And my little girl, who was about 4 years old, followed me down to the sidewalk to the car, crying for me to stay at home that night. And that shook me to my very foundations. When I rode out down the highway that night, the conversation went something like this. Old boy, you must have a glorified concept of yourself. What are you trying to do, save the whole world by yourself? What if you do save the whole world and lose your own son or daughter? And I've failed in 1,000 ways. I can say anything here this morning because my wife's not here. I've failed in 1,000 ways. But I started from that day on, putting on an old sports shirt and trousers, slacks. If I'm not going to say I'm going out to speak, if I'm there an hour, I play with those children. Piggyback. I take a 10-year-old to putt-putt. I'll take him bowling. Took a 15-year-old to the Dixie Classics. I had a daughter of a minister who has written 15 books, and you'd know his name if I called it. I had his daughter sit in my office about the 7th or 8th hour when she was highly emotional at the time, and she yelled out and said, I wish to the Lord he'd written one less book. She said, I never remember him coming into the backyard. A simple thing like swinging me, pushing me in the swing. It was always, Daddy, be quiet. Be quiet, Daddy's working. And I happen to know that 3 of those children have had to have psychiatric help, all 3 of his children. Again, you wouldn't know who that was in 1,000 years. That home will not be a home of refuge unless you work at it. That's what I'm saying. Thank you.
I've observed your attention, and I rejoice with you that we could get these practical and helpful thoughts today. May I ask that you take this sheet, which has a copy of our seminary hymn. We will not sing it this morning, but these words I hope will be with you and about so that you can look at them often, because there is a great deal of what this seminary has to say to every student in the hymn. Now may we stay. Thank you.